From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. It is Friday, May the 9th. Thanks for being with us. Coming up, the U.S. President-elect out on the road with a thank you tour. What a Trump administration might do about America's new attitudes toward Cuba.
He's willing to go back and forth, make demands or put conditions to any further movements on the side of the U.S.
Also ahead, electing that is, a president in Ghana, death of renowned American astronaut, and the latest from the world of films and singer superstars. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump made a third stop late Thursday on his thank you tour of America at a rally in the city of Des Moines, Iowa.
What great people, great people. I'm here today for one main reason, to say thank you to the great, great people of Iowa. You went out and pounded, and I mean pounded, the pavement. You organized your fellow citizens and propelled us to victories at a grassroots and every other level. We have a movement the likes of which this world has never seen before. Never seen before. I also want to give a very special thanks to our veterans. A lot of veterans in this room. Thank you. Thank you. Service members, military families, unbelievable people. Yesterday was the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. And a reminder of the countless Americans who made the ultimate sacrifice for this and our country. America's men and women in uniform are the finest and bravest the world has ever known. And by the way, folks, we are going to be building up our military. It will no longer be a depleted military, I promise. So to all serving in our military, and to all veterans who wore the uniform before, I say to you now on behalf of a very, very grateful nation, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Mr. Trump called Iowa Governor Terry Branstad to the stage in Des Moines to announce him as his choice to be the next ambassador to China. That stop in Des Moines also featured the first protest of the thank you tour. Several small groups shouted Mr. Trump as he took the stage on Thursday night. One held a sign that read, "Iowa says no." President-elect dismissed them by saying, and I quote, "They're on our side, they just don't know it yet." A handful of U.S. lawmakers has joined dozens of Cuban entrepreneurs in calling on President-elect Trump to maintain the path of normalizing relations with Cuba set in motion 2 years ago by President Obama. Business people like Marla Recio Carvajal says their businesses have grown as a result.
The changes made by the U.S., such as increasing flights, increasing travelers to Cuba, facilitating commerce, this have been important because it has made our business grow. So this is such an important moment for Cubans. We are worried about the future, and that's why we're here today representing our businesses, representing the rest of the Cuban entrepreneurs, and all of our families, because our families depend on these changes and this relationship moving forward. So our message is that we want the U.S.-Cuba relationship to continue. No nos den la espalda. Please don't turn your back on us.
Appealing, that is, to Mr. Trump's experience as a real estate developer, the letter by more than 100 Cuban private business owners states in part, "As a successful businessman, we're confident that you understand the importance of economic engagement between nations." That letter was organized by two groups, one, Cuba Educational Travel, and the lobby group Engage Cuba. Ted Henkin, a professor of Latin American Studies at Baruch College in New York and an author of A Boon on Business in Cuba, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, given Mr. Trump's campaign rhetoric, it is not easy to determine what U.S. policy toward Havana will be after Mr. Trump becomes president.
To me, the takeaway is that Obama changed the rules of the game in terms of Cuba. Obama made it safe to do deals with the Cuban government, whereas before that was taboo. Trump has not left that off the table. He just is making threats that if he doesn't get his demands met. So he's willing to, let's say, go back and forth, make demands or put conditions to any further, let's say, movements on the side of the U.S. I think that this news, however, is very well targeted in the sense that it gets the voices of Cuban entrepreneurs involved in the conversation, which is really important given that Trump is famous for being someone who can do deals as a businessman, and these are fledgling capitalists in a socialist system who are asking for his help to continue the opening and the trade and the engagement and the tourism that all help them do business and grow their businesses. That is a message that it's going to be hard for someone in the Republican Party who's a businessman to ignore.
With the death of Fidel Castro, does the dynamic change at all?
Potentially it does, given that the assumption always has been that Fidel has been the ideologue hardliner and has really always considered concessions to the market to be anathema. And they were really only introduced during the 90s when he had no choice during the economic crisis of the special period. And then since he stepped down under his brother for the last 10 years, you've had a new opening to the market. And so the fact that he is out of the way will be symbolic and psychologically important, removing, you can say, the traditional support that Cuban hardliners have had.
Ted Josevina Vidal, the Cuban Foreign Ministry's Director of U.S. Affairs, said at a news conference on Wednesday that Cuba hopes to sign off at least half a dozen more agreements with the U.S. before Mr. Trump takes office. We've talked before about 2 years on to normalizing relations. This trend is irreversible. Do you still feel that way?
I think the trend is irreversible. I think, however, what's in question now is the speed at which that trend happens.
Ted Henkin also said, ironically, it would be Donald Trump who might be the one to lift the U.S. trade embargo on Cuba, provided the communist leadership offers some concessions, such as settling the longstanding compensation claims by expropriated U.S. businesses. Among some of the stories we're following here on the Voice of America, earthquakes striking off the Solomon Islands and the U.S. state of California. Wait stretching for the official Ghana election results, plus Britain and Western nations might be facing some grave threats to their security and political systems. Get more on those stories at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app.
Godspeed, John Glenn. 10, 9, 8, 7.
That is the liftoff of the U.S. Atlas rocket on February 20, 1962, topped a capsule called the Friendship 7. A nearly five-hour flight around the world made John Glenn the first U.S. astronaut to orbit Earth. Glenn died Thursday. He was 95. He had been admitted more than a week ago to Ohio State University's James Cancer Hospital, according to the John Glenn College of Public Affairs. He was the last surviving member of a group known as the Mercury 7, seven military test pilots selected in 1959 to become America's first astronauts.
Yeah, we were competitors. Boy, were we competitors to try and get the different flights. Never was there anything any more tight than the brotherhood we had that supported each one of those flights.
Yes, that is John Lynn. After serving as a military pilot in World War II and the Korean conflict, Glenn was a test pilot of U.S. Navy and Marine Corps jet fighters, won a place in the first class of the U.S. astronauts, assembled by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, also known as NASA. That happened in 1958. Glenn also had aspirations in politics, running as a Democrat for the U.S. Senate, a seat in his home state of Ohio, winning that in 1974. He remained a member of the U.S. Senate until 1999 and was the oldest living member of the Senate until his death. Catapulted into the spotlight by the 1962 space flight, Glenn went on to win numerous accolades, including honorary degrees at universities around the country, the World Woodrow Wilson Award for Public Service, a U.S. Senate Public Service Award, and the Presidential Freedom of Medal Freedom in 2011.
For many, many thousands of years, people had looked up and wondered, they'd been curious, about what was up there. And we must consider ourselves among the most fortunate of all generations, for we have lived at a time when the dream became a reality.
Glenn made his final trip into space in 1998 while still a senator after persuading NASA to send him on a space flight. It was a shuttle flight. He was 77 years old at the time and became the oldest man ever to fly in space. His participation in that 9-day mission was criticized by some as folly, but supporters said it provided valuable data on the effects of space life on an elderly person, as well as providing data that could be compared with Glenn's space flights from 3 decades earlier. Later in the program, we'll be back with VOA's Michael Lippin for social media response to John Glenn's death. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA. A leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Salih, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Salih saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Main challenger in Ghana's presidential election has said he is confident of victory, but called on supporters to give the Electoral Commission more time to do its work. Nana Akufo-Addo spoke to supporters in Accra as the Electoral Commission slowly released provisional results from Wednesday's election via Twitter. The main opposition party, the MPP, citing its own tabulations, has declared Akufo-Addo the winner of the election, and 5 other opposition candidates have followed suit. However, incumbent President John Mahama and his ruling NDC party have not conceded defeat. The Electoral Commission said it believes the electronic transmission of results from polling centers has been compromised and is only releasing results when it receives physical documents from the field. Here's VOA's Peter Claudy in Accra.
The Constitution does not give a specific time frame for the Electoral Commission to announce results. It gives the Electoral Commission all the powers it needs to administer election results. However, if the Electoral Commission sees anything untoward that could compromise the credibility of the election, it would have to investigate and then determine its next line of action before deciding when to announce the results. And this morning when I spoke with the spokesperson of the Electoral Commission, Eric Jakwasu, he said there have been instances where there appear to be overvoting. Overvoting means if there are 20 people in the voter list, and the 25 people voted, that means it's overvoting. They have to investigate and probably invalidate that polling station. That will take the polling station out of contention, and the results will not be added to the national tally. So these are some of the things that they are looking at before coming out to announce certified results for the presidential election.
That is Peter Claudy in Accra. President Mahama is seeking a second term as leader of Ghana, a major exporter of oil as well as gold and cocoa. Akufo-Addo, a former foreign minister, has seized on Ghana's current economic woes as a campaign theme, accusing Mahama and the NDC of incompetence. On December 1st, five West African countries agreed to stop importing diesel fuel from Europe that has a high sulfur content. It is known as dirty fuel, and its emissions worsen air pollution and contribute to health problems. UN environmental officials praise the agreement but say Africa has a long way to go to meet modern air pollution standards. VOA's Joe DiCapua has our report.
Just seven of Africa's 54 countries have already stopped importing the dirty diesel. All are in East Africa, except for Morocco and Mauritius. The West African countries that have agreed to join them are Nigeria, Benin, Togo, Ghana, and Ivory Coast. Their decision does not take effect immediately. Ghana will stop imports in March, and the rest will follow suit next July. Three countries in Southern Africa could agree to ban the dirty diesel next year. Jane Akumu focuses on transport issues in Africa for UN Environment.
We've been working on this program for several years now. We started in 2002 with the elimination of lead in petrol, and by 2005, the sub-Saharan Africa region had actually eliminated lead in petrol. So from then, so about 2006, that's when we started the South, especially in the diesel, because of the health benefits and environmental benefits.
Millions of deaths every year are blamed on air pollution. Dirty diesel emissions are linked to asthma, bronchitis, lung cancer and stroke, as well as heart-related problems. Health officials say children are especially susceptible.
Diesel emissions, especially from the heavy-duty vehicles, the buses, the trucks, are a major contributor to black carbon, which is the second most important climate pollutant.
Black carbon results from the incomplete combustion of fossil fuels. Akumu says while Europe now uses cleaner diesel, some traders there are able to sell dirty diesel to Africa by blending it with other fuels with a lower sulfur content. Traders are taking advantage of the lax fuel standards in many African countries. Much of the dirty fuels exported to Africa come from the Netherlands. Akumu says the low-sulfur diesel should not cost consumers more.
I think the next step would also be to look at the kind of vehicles that are coming into these countries. So we've been partnering with countries to introduce cleaner fuels, but the ultimate objective is actually to combine the cleaner fuels and the cleaner vehicles to have vehicle emission standards, which are still lacking in Africa.
Africa imports many older used vehicles. Akumu says, for example, the average age of a car in Ghana is 14 years. UN Environment says a combination of low-sulfur fuels with advanced vehicle standards can reduce harmful emissions by vehicles by as much as 90%. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
It is time now to check out what's happening on social media. International Edition's Michael Lippin here with the latest, including the buzz about John Glenn's death. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Steve. Well, one of the first to announce Glenn's passing was the governor of Glenn's home state of Ohio, John Kasich. He posted this note on his Twitter feed. John Glenn is and always will be Ohio's ultimate hometown hero, and his passing today is an occasion for all of us to grieve. Though he soared deep into space and to the heights of Capitol Hill, and Kasich's making a reference to Glenn's 24 years as a Democratic senator for the state of Ohio, Kasich said he never strayed from his steadfast Ohio roots. And then there was this message from U.S. Space Agency NASA. We are saddened by the loss of Senator John Glenn, the first American to orbit Earth. A true American hero. Godspeed, John Glenn. And then NASA added this phrase, ad astra, which is Latin for to the stars.
Michael, how are the nation's top political leaders responding?
Well, U.S. President-elect Donald Trump also paid tribute with this tweet, his first of the day. Today we lost a great pioneer of air and space in John Glenn. He was a hero and inspired generations of future explorers. He will be missed. News outlets also have been tweeting President Obama's statement on Glenn. In it, Obama says, "With John's passing, our nation has lost an icon, and Michelle and I have lost a friend. The last of America's first astronauts has left us." You might notice a similar theme there from Obama and Trump, and that didn't go unnoticed for one U.S. political commentator, Anna Navarro. She tweeted this note, "It's been a while since I recall anything unifying us. Thank you, John Glenn, for that last gift to America, bringing us together in celebration of you."
And I understand that the Twitter world has been celebrating something else today. What's that all about?
Well, yes, it's hashtag National Brownie Day, when Americans everywhere are supposed to gobble up as many brownies as they can. Okay, well, there's no real compulsion there, but I wouldn't mind having a brownie right now. You know, one of our colleagues, Dave DeForest, is rather good at supplying us with brownies. He does it almost every Sunday, so we're practically having Brownie Day on a weekly basis. Thank you, Dave, if you're listening. For all other brownie fans out there, check out hashtag National Brownie Day for some brownie-inspired gifts, including one featuring Homer Simpson of The Simpsons animated TV series, probably one of the most prolific brownie eaters on TV. You can also learn about Chicago's historic Palmer House Hilton Hotel, which claims to have invented and served America's first ever brownie in 1893. It was a dessert that it named Bertha's Famous Brownie after the wife of Potter Palmer, the businessman who built that hotel in 1871. Back to you, Steve.
Absolutely. I like them. Yes, Dave DeForest makes some nice brownies. Michael Lippin, International Edition social media guru, among all the many other things he does for us. You can find Michael on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
For Tebby Satoli, it all started at a car cleaning service, washing cars, and then as a receptionist, where she learned all she could about the business.
It was a job, but I didn't know that one of the days I would be owning my shop.
As the owner of G&T Auto Body, Tebby Satoli is rare in a business dominated by men. Her shop sits in a suburb northwest of Johannesburg, where she paints and makes structural repairs to automobiles. Using her savings and taking out loans, she was able to secure the business after she convinced enough people she knew what she was doing.
The minute when I start to discuss the damage on a car, when I'm estimating, that's when they starting to realize that this person, though it's a female, she knows what she's doing.
South Africa has a 27% unemployment rate, but G&T has 15 employees today with sales over $400,000 a year. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, there's a new film out there based on the acclaimed children's novel, A Monster Calls. International Edition's David Byrd tells us the film tells the story of a boy coming to terms with his mother's terminal illness.
Connor O'Malley has been plagued by nightmares. The 13-year-old shy, artistic boy is also the victim of his school bully. At 7 minutes past midnight, Connor keeps hearing a voice call to him from his bedroom window, which overlooks a churchyard with a giant yew tree. One night, Connor meets a monster, a massive tangle of roots and branches in human form. The monster tells Connor that he summoned it, and it will help him by telling him three short stories. In return, Connor must tell stories of his own. As Connor and the monster continue to meet, almost always at 12:07 a.m., we learn that Connor's mother, played by Felicity Jones, has terminal cancer. Connor is forced to move in with his cold, emotionally detached grandmother, played by Sigourney Weaver. The monster's stories are intended to teach the boy about life, but they continued to have increasing consequences, including the smashing of his grandmother's living room and the attacking of his nemesis at school. Liam Neeson provides the voice of the monster.
I don't know if you've read the book by Patrick Ness. It's an extraordinary, it really is like a classic book. And it just, you know, you close over the last page, and certainly with me, it just really gets you thinking about aspects of your life.
When Connor tells his own nightmare, he begins to confront his feelings about his mother's imminent death. The monster reveals that he has been sent to help Connor heal, and when the boy accepts his mother's terminal illness, she dies in the hospital at 7 minutes after midnight. Newcomer Lewis McDougall plays Connor.
Well, I guess really I would use like experiences in my own life to try and understand what Connor's feeling, but you know, also there was the fact that I had to do an English accent, which I'm Scottish, of course, and so I had to do a bit of dialect coaching for that, and I actually had a couple weeks of rehearsals with everybody, including Liam, and so that was very helpful.
Neeson says that McDougall embodied the nuances and the emotions Connor experiences in a way not usually seen in child actors.
Terrific kid, and what a performance he gives. I mean, I've made quite a few movies with quite a few children. This boy is brilliant. He really is. It's a brilliant performance.
Sigourney Weaver says that she, director J.A. Bayona, and Felicity Jones did their homework to make sure that their performances were true to life.
You know, Felicity and I and Bayona, we did meet with doctors in England, cancer specialists. We also went to hospice to see what the challenges of taking care of someone in the last stages of cancer would be. So we did kind of fill up on that, and I know she also met with women survivors of cancer.
A Monster Calls is based on the book by Patrick Ness, who also wrote the Chaos Walking series for children. The film premiered at the Toronto Film Festival and will have a wide U.S. release beginning December 23rd. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And many thanks to you, Dave, and many thanks to all of you for being with us here on The Voice of America. From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There have been significant accomplishments in promoting religious liberty at the State Department in recent years, said Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, David Saperstein.
Clearly, as you look back on my 2 years here at the State Department, our ability to assist Secretary of State Kerry in his finding that ISIL's activities in Iraq constituted genocide against the Yazidis, Christian Shia communities, and crimes against humanity against the Kakai and the Mandeans and other minority groups was a very important achievement here, and kind of had the impact of grabbing the attention of the international community.
This worldwide attention made it possible to hold two pledging conferences that helped raise over $2.2 million from countries around the world to help these religious minorities return home safely. The United States as a country will continue its commitment to the principle of religious freedom at home and abroad, said Ambassador Saperstein.
I am very optimistic that the robust efforts on behalf of religious freedom that has marked the last several administrations, Republican and Democrat, will remain a hallmark of our foreign policy moving into the future. It really shows the consensus view that religion plays such an influential role in foreign policy issues that we confront and must be addressed more effectively, must engage religious communities around the world on behalf of the values and interests that we promulgate.
Religious liberty is one of America's great contributions to the world, said Ambassador Saperstein. And as an American, I'm extraordinarily proud to see how many countries join us in that vision of the fundamental rights of people to live equally as citizens without regard to their religion. The United States is making a difference in the world on this issue and will continue to do so.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.